we're meeting to celebrate Sangha Day, Sangha being one of the three jewels, and we're going to be thinking about what Sangha means to us individually and collectively as well. So I've been thinking about giving this talk over the last few weeks and decided on the title, Sangha as Practice, the Challenges and the Joys. And my thinking was that whenever people are involved, whenever there's interaction between beings, that can result in joy or it can be challenging. And I'm hoping I'm not the only one who feels about the challenging bit as well, okay? And I remember thinking many years ago that if it wasn't for other people, then my practice would be straightforward, yeah? And I continue to have that thought at times as well, okay? So I'm going to try to explore Sangha as practice and see where that takes us, yeah? So I've taken stuff from the Pali Canon, from our own movement, from a podcast by Domyo Burke, who's a Soto Zen practitioner, and an article by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist practitioner. So Sangha as practice, Sangha as spiritual practice. So as Berry Devi said earlier on, when we say I take refuge in the Sangha, it's not theoretical, it's not static, it's not fixed, but it's a practice, something that we do regularly and we do intentionally. And as Berry Devi also said, we're taking refuge in the Arya Sangha, to the Buddha and to those stream entrants and beyond. Some of those who are on the refuge tree on the shrine here. And we're doing so alongside a group of friends who are motivated by the same Buddhist values and ideals and practice. So when I'm using the word Sangha today, I'm referring to our local Sangha, to us, to this group of friends, and this coming together in our collective connectedness, and the dissolving of boundaries, and the differences that we, or rather I'll own this, that I can put between what I call me and what I call other, yeah? So you might know that Sangha is that a Sanskrit word which means community that joins together and lives together as well. So almost like a network made up of people who are existing together, interact together and form a whole, not only sharing spiritual values but also offering us support for each other as well. So the existence of Sangha is what makes Buddhism a living spiritual tradition, rather than just a philosophy, yeah? Just a theoretical philosophy. And it's not just ideas about the Buddha's teaching, but applying them in our lives, translating them into action. So the Sangha is the context in which we apply them. It's the relational context of our practice. And with Sangha comes relationships, and with relationships comes the opportunity for spiritual friendship. So let's start with three teachings that the Buddha gave about the importance of spiritual friendship. Firstly, in the Upada Sutta, it says that Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and devoted companion, observed when he was observing the positive relationships within the Sangha, said to the Buddha, Lord, I think half of the holy life is spiritual friendship, the association with the lovely. And the Buddha replied, that's not so. Say that's not so, Ananda. It is not half of the holy life, it is the whole of the holy life. And also in the Magiya Sutta, the Buddha lists spiritual friendship when speaking to an enthusiastic young monk, Magiya, who wants to go off and do his own thing. And he says there are five things induce release of the heart and lasting peace. First, a deep intimacy with good friends. Second, ethical conduct. Third, frequent conversation that inspires and encourages practice. Fourth, diligence, energy and enthusiasm for the good. And fifth, insight into impermanence. So the Buddha placed spiritual friendship up there in his top five, yeah? And in the story of Aniruddha, where the Buddha came across a the community that Anuruddha was living in with his two friends. And the Buddha had previously come into contact with a monastery of monks who had fallen out with each other. So he asks Anuruddha how it is that his community is living together so harmoniously. And Anuruddha says, "Venerable sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in this holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards these venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. And I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. And I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and I do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind." So spiritual friendship is Kalyana Mitrata in Pali, and Kalyana can be translated as beautiful, helpful and ethically good. And Mitrata as friendship or companionship, so hence friends in the good life or beautiful companionship. And these friendships can be horizontal with peers who are at a similar stage of practice to ourselves, or vertical with those who might be a bit further along the path than we are. And there's benefits and richness in both. And I was on a retreat a few years ago with Subhadramati from the LBC, and I recall her saying that it's spiritual friendship that makes us a Buddhist movement rather than a Buddhist evening class. And Tri Ratna is often described as a movement of connections and relationships, and with that comes challenges and joys, yeah? So we have the opportunity today to reflect on our relationship to Sangha. What is our history with the Sangha? What are our patterns and our habits? Do we go beyond our constricted, limited selves in the Sangha? Do we model and inspire? What are we drawn towards and what are we pushing away? Are there ways we could be more fearless in our friendships? Where could we let go? Where is our particular work regarding Sangha? Where are our own joys and challenges? So Sangha actually plays a great deal of emphasis on Sangha when setting up the movement, and he defined spiritual friendship as the organising principle around which both the Sangha and practice are based, saying that spiritual friendship gives us two opportunities to develop our practice. Firstly, as a way of overcoming the self-obsessive and self-referential view that we can have as Westerners living in a culture that's encouraging individualism and achievement and competitiveness. Yeah? And secondly, as an aspect of the goal of enlightenment itself. So let's just think about this. It can be easy to think of our Buddhist practice as being individualistic and solitary. While an important part of our practice is personal and inwardly focused, a potentially more significant part is interpersonal, the rich world of relating with others. Initially, interpersonal practice influences individual practice, and then as time goes on, we begin to realise that it's not about us and them, but in fact there isn't such a thing as a static, non-changing us or a static, non-changing them. And this is where the aspect of wisdom might come in, seeing the connectedness of all phenomena and how everything, including all of us and spiritual friendship, does not exist independently from each other, but all are dependent upon conditions. So Sangharakshita also said, enlightenment is a state in which we transcend the small self-referential frame of reference and become a friend of the world. In effect, we take our mundane human friendliness and raise it to a new level, so that we're united in a friendliness to all other people, to all other beings, and to the universe itself. We cannot hope to achieve this universal friendliness unless we start by behaving as a friend to at least a few real people. Yeah. So, I chose to call this talk Sangha as Practice, The Challenges and the Joys. And I thought that was rather a fab title, okay? But I've been on a real journey with it, actually. And as I began to try and write it, I just couldn't separate out clearly the two categories of challenges and joys. And the more I tried to polarise them, the more I couldn't. And the more I really began to see that labels and concepts are just so clumsy, and that they just don't describe the whole true picture. So I saw that the umbrella term challenges that can present us with opportunities to practice, and that this can transform the challenge into a joy, where which is there, the joy is real, but then it fades away again. Yeah. So I had a bit of a wobble when I realised that my nice clean categories were not going to work, and I needed to review my thinking. And I was like, need a rewrite here, need a rethink, need a rewrite. So a lesson to me in the universal law of impermanence, of everything changing, of nothing being fixed, that we can't hold on to joy no matter how hard we grasp or how hard we try. And this constant arising and ceasing of challenges and joys, yeah? In everything, just how life is, how everything is. Conditions influence something coming into being, and conditions influence it ceasing to be. And that's what life is, what practice is, this flow of conditions, and sometimes any type of labelling, never mind labelling good or bad, it's not helpful. And maybe just living would sum it up more precisely, or maybe working with suffering. Yeah? So I will admit at this point that my title was not very helpful, and it turned out to be a bit rubbish actually. Because Sangha is Sangha, and by definition, it encompasses everything that happens in relationships between beings. Yeah? The whole spectrum of emotions. So I'm renaming my talk, Sangha as Practice, full stop. So let's think a little bit more about relationships. Sangha actually said, and this is a bit of a long quote, developing friendships is part of the way that we can grow. We transcend our egotism and break out of the box of our self-concern by deep and open communication, by developing empathy, by becoming more concerned for others, and by developing qualities such as loyalty and gratitude. We need friendship to develop metta, compassion, and sympathetic joy. Ultimately, we aim to experience these things for other beings, for all other beings, but we need to start with our friends, who are not linked to us by ties of blood or self-interest, but for whom we feel warm affection. Spiritual friends also help us to see ourselves more clearly, an essential part of growth. We all have aspects of ourselves that we hide from others, which makes it very difficult to work on them. Learning to be open and honest with others, taking off our mask, although I don't think Sangharakshita would have understood what that actually means when he actually wrote this, helps us to leave these hidden aspects of ourselves behind and move on. We also have blind spots, aspects of ourselves that we do not know about, which we even hide from ourselves. Spiritual friends who take our spiritual well-being to heart, rather than colluding with us for an easy life, will help us see these blind spots. Unless we're open to seeing ourselves as others see us, we will probably never move forward, because we will not know ourselves as we really are. End of quote. So I think we're beginning to see that although there's much to be gained from spiritual friendships, it might not always feel comfortable process. Yeah. So good friends are an important source of feedback, and our mindlessness can be seen more clearly if we're around mindful people. Yeah. To ourselves, our lack of ethical behaviour can be highlighted to ourselves by being with people who are more ethical than us. And also those around us can affirm when we're doing well and celebrate our progress and celebrate our achievements. But relationships can be tricky. And we're working with our stuff, we're all working with our stuff. and the stuff of our conditioning alongside people who are working with their stuff as well. Yeah, and it's not always easy. Sometimes it's very painful, and we need courage. It needs courage to work with discomfort, as this often offers us an opportunity to grow and to break free from the limited ways that we see ourselves. Yeah. So spiritual friendship can bring out the best in us, and it can reveal the beauty in the world, but it can also bring out the worst in us. Our reactivity, our resistance, all right, my reactivity, my resistance, turbulence can be stirred up in our interactions with others. And it's quite common for others to see things about ourselves that we don't see. And having these things pointed out can be extremely helpful. We can't hide, but by creating trust and goodwill, if we can establish that, it might allow for frank discussions about our behaviour and our practice and our understanding. Sometimes I've really struggled with getting feedback on how my speech or my actions have impacted on others. It's challenged the story of how I view myself. But what I've learned is if I'm able to engage with it, if I'm able to keep my heart open and hear it and take responsibility for my part, yeah? In the most difficult and painful interactions, something has been transformed, which has led to a deeper, more pure and honest connection with the other person. So the ideal is the best of me communicating with the best in the other person as well, yeah? So in the Sangha, there's an opportunity to practice ethical and skillful friendship, and it's a training to work with greed, hatred and delusion, to develop caring and compassionate relationships with others rather than harmful ones, generous ones rather than greedy ones, and honest ones rather than dishonest ones, as well as developing the wisdom aspect of going beyond self. And we don't use the usual strategies that we use in everyday social situations, yeah, within the Sangha. And I think that this can be disconcerting. I'm just thinking about the relationships that I have in the Sangha compared to relationships that I might have with work colleagues as well, yeah? And we're often practicing alongside people that we would not come into contact with in our usual social context. So it's not unusual to be here in the Sangha. It's not unusual to be here at a Sangha event or on a retreat or in a discussion group, face-to-face or online, with someone who pushes all of your buttons. Yeah? Exactly the sort of person that you would avoid at all costs in ordinary life. Yeah? And they're there sitting across from you in the room. They remind you of a parent, a sibling, a childhood enemy, or someone who really gets on your nerves at work. Because this is what happens in relationships. We're triggered. And we have to work with our own responses. And here in the Sangha, we have to deal with relationships in ways that we never have to if left to your own devices. So outside in the Sangha, we have the opportunity to avoid people, not get back in contact with them, sideline them in our day-to-day life, yeah? Sever contact, but we don't have that opportunity in the Sangha. It isn't a choice for us. We do have an opportunity to lean in and to work with our responses and to notice what goes on, what is going on, what has been triggered in our mind and body, and to practice patience and forbearance, yeah? I was once struggling with a colleague, and I remember saying to Sinachandra, she does this, she says this, and she goes on about this, and you know, it makes me feel like this. I remember Sinachandra looking at me with such kindness and saying, but this is really great. She's given you such a gift. She's given you an opportunity to practice. And every day she's doing that for you. And she was right. She was right. Although at the time I didn't want it to be at all. I wanted her to collude with my righteous indignation. Yeah, I really wanted her to collude. But she would not have been a good friend to me if she had colluded. And she had the wisdom to know that. So the Sangha isn't perfect, and it doesn't have to be. There's always going to be friction because we're not enlightened yet. And I think we can glean from the Buddha's teachings that his Sangha was not perfect either, and that we might have ideas about how the Sangha should be, or ideas about how Buddhists should be, and have judgments or disappointments when we realise that our fellow Buddhists, especially order members, are still rather opinionated or rude or struggling or not taking us into account. But we're all on a journey of discovery and learning, and we're learning to face those difficulties head on as well. Yeah, so we're admitting that we're not perfect, and we're actively working towards greater wisdom and compassion around this. And I know that I have deeper and more meaningful conversations with people in the Sangha than in other areas of my life. And I'm working towards allowing others to see me as I truly am. In the Sangha, we see vulnerability in others, and we can show our vulnerability, and we see weakness, anger, jealousy, arrogance. And this allows to acknowledge those states in ourselves as well. And we can be inspired by experience or witnessing someone's loving kindness. We can celebrate that we've come across the Dharma together. And we can enjoy being alongside each other on our individual journeys, seeing both small and enormous progresses that are being made. We can stand together in our humanity. So for me, relationships in the Sangha has in the past and can continue to bring up all kinds of stuff. Wanting validation and approval, feeling sensitivity to perceived criticism, comparing, fear of not being good enough, avoidance of emotional intimacy, but also pure joy, depth of connection, cleanness of communication, previously not experienced in other relationships. The appreciation of inner beauty that comes from living by the precepts, trying to live by the precepts. And I've learned on this path that I'm responsible for what happens within my own mind and heart, and there's only me who can work with this. Yes, I can be touched by the world around me, but ultimately nothing outside makes me feel or makes me react in a certain way. It's not enough just to say I don't like somebody, I don't warm to somebody. I'm trying to ask what's going on in my mind that's causing that reaction. I'm trying to stop worrying about what's going on with others, which mostly I can't influence, and work on what I can influence, which is my own mind on a good day. Yeah? So I'm learning that person is my Dharma sister or brother, whether I want them to be or not. Yeah? And it gives me the opportunity to practice both compassion and self-compassion. And we can't learn this from books. Or we can't learn this by being of ourselves, practicing by ourselves. But it has the potential to be transformational. And our development has the potential to influence others as well. And as human beings, we're social creatures. So we inspire each other. Domyo Burke said, "The vast majority of human interactions that cause friction or conflict are not actually serious matters. Most people, including myself," he's saying, "could benefit from erring on the side of acceptance, non-reactivity and inclusiveness about 99 times out of 100 when we feel a negative reaction to someone or their behaviour." And I feel that's an invitation to all of us. It might be a little less than 99, but still it's up there, isn't it? Of course, there's times that sometimes that we have every right to feel hurt, and we need to bring our own needs into interaction, have the courage to speak to another person about how a relationship has made us feel. But sometimes also it's our pride, it's our ego, it's our fixed sense of self that's wounded. And this gives us the chance to consider this deeply. Is there a pattern here? What's really going on for me? What is it in my particular conditioning that's being triggered here? So there's an opportunity for insight and for freedom. So some of the points that were raised in the recent visioning events were, how do we look after Sangha? How do we build Sangha cohesion? And how do we build in resilience? And I've been thinking about that word resilience, and I looked it up in the dictionary, and it says, the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties, the ability to spring back into shape, and elasticity. And I feel that COVID is proven challenging to bounce back from. We all respond to suffering in different ways. Some of us reach out to others, some of us go into ourselves and isolate ourselves. And there's been lots of suffering in the last 18 months. That has had an impact on our Sangha. And it feels important to acknowledge that we're only just coming out of, and we're not completely out of the pandemic. And that this is the most collective traumatic time in our life history. And I think we're in a period of recovery. And it might be a physical recovery for some of us, but you know, I feel certain that it's a psychological recovery for all of us. And on top of that, collectively, as a Sangha, we agreed to sell the centre. And we're now in a process around what our next step might be, and that's taking a lot of thoughtfulness and a lot of energy as well. So we've got lots going on, past and present. But all we have is now. This moment, so you know, we can think about how we really want to use that. So I've been thinking about how being part of the Sangha, being part of this Sangha, comes with responsibility. Actually, that's been coming up for me. It provides an opportunity to be generous, and that might be with time, it might be with emotions, it might be with support, it might be with faith. It might be with money. We've got a Dana ball over there today. And the process of writing this talk has brought up some difficult stuff for me. I've become aware that lockdown coincided with me feeling more confident about my practice, actually, less reliant on others. And I didn't feel that I needed as much Sangha fuel as I might have in the past. And that's made me realise that the stronger we feel our practice is, maybe the more that we have to offer, and therefore me not inputting into visioning events, which I did not, okay, because I wanted a lazy day, is me maybe not taking my responsibility to the Sangha seriously. And we all might have different kind of relationships with in different ways that we can maybe think about today. I was not contributing to the Sangha energy, but also I denied myself because I did not let myself benefit from the Sangha energy as well. And we also don't have to bring just our energy or our joy or our contentment or our good progress to the Sangha, but we can also bring our sore bits and our suffering and our imperfections and our messiness. And spiritual friends are people who see us as we really are and love us anyway. So we bring all of our being to our practice. We bring all of our being to the Sangha. And the Sangha is practice. So in answer to those questions, how do we create coherence, cohesion, and resilience? So I believe that the relational aspect of Sangha both nurtures and nourishes practice, that our mindful presence can contribute deeply and significantly to the multifaceted quality of Sangha. And when our energy of mindfulness is combined with others, that we might be able to get a glimpse, or more of a glimpse, of beauty and of joy, wholeheartedness and upliftedness. If we can all take on the responsibility of relationship building and spiritual friendship with clarity, with good boundaries, and what I mean by that is like sensitivity to others around when to bring difficult stuff in, awareness, kindness, and practice clear, honest and open communication, appreciate and having gratitude to one another, rejoicing in what we do well, and absorbing, taking on board any positive feedback we might get as well. It might be helpful to acknowledge that there's ups and downs in our sanghaing, and that that's perfectly okay. The Zen teacher, Norma Norman Fisher said, the nature of spiritual friendship never depends on division or discrimination between people. It is boundless, empty, open and free. So I'm going to finish with a bit of a mashup from different sources. One of the activities of the ideal Buddhist is to stimulate positive emotions in other beings. Live deeply the moments of your days. And like a rain cloud, open up and give yourself. Be the person you need. You are enough. Liberate your heart by love. Thank you.